Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. I'm one of your usual hosts, Lee Hutchison. We mentioned before on the show that me and Dallas have a second podcast on the network, The A24 Project, which looks at two films from the A24 filmography every 2 weeks, and we've been lucky enough to have been joined by the talent involved in bringing those films to the screen for some bonus interview episodes along the way. When life gets in the way or me and Dallas go on holiday, we'll aim to bring you some of these interview episodes to enjoy here on Filibuster, and hopefully you'll get something from them too. For our first crossover release, here's our interview with composer Richard Vreeland, aka Disasterpiece. Vreeland discusses his early career in video game composing, working on the amazing It Follows soundtrack with David Robert Mitchell, and the opportunities that followed, the challenges of scoring and working on Under the Silver Lake, what happened with the release of that film, and composing music for a Netflix film, Triple Frontier, and much more. Hope you enjoyed the interview, and we'll be back again soon. What were your early musical inspirations, and what turned a passion into considering a career in composing?
Well, I kind of got into music, at least like on the writing side. I got into music a little bit late. I probably started messing around with my own ideas when I was in high school, so probably like when I was 16 or 17. But certainly I was grew up in a musical household. My mother and my stepfather were in the music department at our church, and so they'd have band practices in our basement, and my sister was a singer, growing up. So there's a lot of music around.
And when did you sort of think about it as like, I really want to go off and potentially make this sort of a career? Was there a moment that you thought this is actually doable?
Yeah, there was definitely a moment like that. In the beginning, I was just, making music because it was fun. And at some point, I felt like, I was really passionate about it and decided to go away to music school. But before that happened, I had been, I'd been making music for a couple of years, and I'd been posting a lot of it online. And a friend at the time saw a wanted ad on a message board for music for a mobile game, and he passed my music along and told me about it, and then didn't hear anything, but I followed up like maybe a couple months later, and they ended up needing some music. So that was my first, that ended up being my first project that I worked on, and I was probably around 20 years old at the time.
Was there any sort of composers that you were looking up to as sort of like they've managed to make this a great career and that inspired you potentially?
I think I was just in sort of the early throes of that. I definitely was really into classic video game music at that time. And so, I didn't necessarily know a lot about the composers, but, I knew that I liked the music. Composers like Yasunori Mitsuda and Koji Kondo and Hip Tanaka, people like that.
When did sort of the name Disasterpiece kind of come into being?
That name, that came about before I started working on soundtracks. So I was probably like 18 or 19, and I wanted to start a band, or at least I said that I did. But I had this habit of, I grew up as a graphic designer. I did a lot of visual art, and I had this tendency of like coming up with an idea for a project or a company or something, and before I actually got into the nuts and bolts of doing a project, I would make artwork for it or make logos and things like that. So Disasterpiece was a name I came up with for a fictional band that, maybe I would start or something. And it kind of sprung out of that. At first I spelled it P-I-E-C-E, but then I found out that there was a Slipknot song that had that name, so I changed it to P-E-A-C-E, which I ended up liking better anyway. Yeah, that was a long time ago. I'm glad that, you know, I stuck with the name and that it hasn't, I haven't gotten sick of it.
Video game soundtracks have really continued to grow in reputation over the past couple of decades. What attracted you to them, and how do they help you in finding your voice as a composer?
Well, I think it was probably some of the music that I listened to the most growing up. I mean, certainly I had influences outside of games. I grew up in, you know, like my parents listened to, you know, they listened to the Beatles, and every Christmas we listened to Vince Guaraldi. So I got into that. You know, folks like Joni Mitchell, Queen, Led Zeppelin. I mean, this was the kind of music that I grew up with. But at the same time, you know, I spent a lot of time playing video games, so I think that music seeped in as well. And as a teenager, I got really into nu metal and heavy metal and classic rock and prog rock as a guitar player. You know, all of that stuff was definitely kind of informing my creativity. But around the same time, I kind of rediscovering, like, you know, video game music from games that I loved growing up, but also that there were communities of people who were creating music, and they were creating arrangements and covers of that music, but also creating their own original music using old video game sounds and hardware. And all of that I really gravitated towards at that time. And I think part of it was, you know, when I first started making music, I was trying to emulate the sound of a rock band, doing all the production myself, maybe, you know, recording as many of the instruments as I could. And for me at that time, I had no idea what I was doing, and it was very challenging to make anything that met some sort of standard of quality for sound. And so getting into chiptune music or something that, you know, had very simple sound format actually allowed me to iterate on my ideas more quickly and release more music.
What sort of I'm always kind of curious about video games, because I think of there's so many different alternates to a certain action can lead to one way and another way. And how do you sort of compose to all that different options? Is it easy to go down a rabbit hole for sort of composing for video games, or how does that kind of all work for someone like yourself?
Yeah, you can definitely get out of hand. I think it's important to, you know, kind of assess the gameplay and the scenario that you're trying to write music for, and to, you know, tread somewhat thoughtfully and cautiously when you're experimenting and exploring sort of nonlinear concepts for music, because you're opening up a can of worms, so to speak. That possibility space can get really large really quickly. So I think, and sometimes, you know, sometimes you end up doing things that are, while they may be technically very impressive, there may not be any real benefit, or people may not really notice sort of the work that's gone into the structure of the music. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of things to consider, a lot of things to weigh, you know, sort of the time resources that you have, the technical resources that you have, and sort of the end goal, like what is what are you trying to accomplish with the music? I mean, there are you know, there are like approaches that have been done quite a bit that are fairly straightforward. Things like crossfading in different layers, different variations of music. You know, there are like simple things that can do a pretty good job. So I think ultimately you kind of have to wrestle with some big questions about, you know, what your intentions are.
You worked on, your work on Fez got the attention of writer-director David Robert Mitchell. What was it about your work that attracted him to you? And what attracted you to him when you kind of heard about his films and what he hoped to do?
I'm honestly not entirely sure what attracted me to him. I know that he saw something in the sound of that game that carried over well to It Follows. And at first when I heard some of those tracks cut into the film, I thought it was odd. There was a bit of cognitive dissonance there for me, because I had written a lot of those pieces I had written, you know, for very specific contexts that this was totally new to. But I sort of began to understand like the sort of where that was coming from, and sort of the, you know, where the overlaps were between the sort of contemporized but retro inspired kind of approach that I took on Fez and some of the goals with It Follows, you know, having an anachronistic story and setting, but, you know, also being informed by, you know, classic horror films and stuff like that. So it definitely came together for me over time. And then, like, as far as what attracted me to him, you know, I was not familiar with his work before he contacted me. And at the time, I had a bunch of projects that I was working on. And so I was kind of on the fence about doing It Follows. You know, I didn't have a lot to go on, just reading the scripts. But once I watched his first film, The Myth of the American Sleepover, which to me had very little to do, this has very little to do with horror as a genre. And so that sort of piqued my interest. That made me really curious. And it also helped me to understand sort of the trajectory that the film was going to take, that he was going to bring this sort of unique sensibility to a new genre. And that definitely made me a lot more confident in what the movie could be.
Your score for It Follows adds to the kind of classic synth horror sounds of like the 70s and 80s. What's the research process for a composer on a film like this? And how closely do you work with Mitchell to develop a sound for the film?
Well, it's interesting because on It Follows, I basically didn't do any research. I tried to stay as ignorant as I could while still doing good work, so that I wouldn't be like overly influenced or informed, or, you know, just be you know, I wanted to make sure that we were doing something different. And an easy way to do that is to sort of like develop impressions of what something ought to be without getting into the finer details of what makes something what it is. And so for It Follows, you know, most of the temp score that wasn't Fez, because some of the temp score was Fez, most of the rest of the music was music that I was not super familiar with. And I didn't like go and watch any movies, and I didn't have a ton of like familiarity with horror as a genre. I just sort of had a few touchstones, you know, some pop culture references, like, you know, I knew the Psycho theme, and I liked the band Goblin that did a bunch of like Italian horror films from the 80s. And that was sort of the extent of my familiarity with it. So what I did on that project is essentially, you know, would I would pull up a scene to score, and I would listen to the temp a few times and sort of internalize what the temp was doing, and then not listen to it anymore and just, you know, kind of try to forget about it in some sense, but remember, like, remember what the essential sort of elements, or the what I felt like was essential about it, and then try to recreate something new given the temp score as sort of like a creative prompt. And that process seemed to work really, really well for us, especially because I felt like the temp score was really strong. There was a lot of care taken in the placement of temp music and like how the music informed the story, how it underlined sort of the intensity of certain moments. It was a very well-crafted temp score.
I've often heard like kind of composers like sometimes coming into a film, you know, sort of in the tail end of post-production, and directors can often fall in love with that temp score because they've been with it for so long. Have you had the experience of that where you've tried to convince a director to maybe move away from the temp score and to maybe embrace some of your ideas, or can they get kind of too attached to what they've been hearing for months or maybe years?
Yeah, it's definitely challenging. I want to put my trust in the director, as much as I can. Some of that has to be pre-reconnaissance, knowing who you're getting involved with and feeling comfortable that you can put a lot of trust in their creative vision. For It Follows, you know, a decent chunk of the temp score had music from Fez in it. There were probably three or four cues that were temped with Fez. And that proved the biggest challenge with that score. There was one cue in particular that I tried to push away from Fez and could not get it to a place where David was happy with it, felt like it was doing a better job than the temp was doing. And so ultimately that cue ended up being a bit closer to something you'd hear on the Fez soundtrack than I would have liked. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not the end of the world.
Was sort of composing a feature film a step up and a challenge, or did it feel like a natural progression from sort of your video game work?
I think of it as like a separate thing. I wouldn't think of it as like, a step up necessarily. But I think, you know, a lot of the work that I had done in games certainly prepared me to do a film score. And I'd also, you know, there's a lot of games that have cutscenes and, you know, there's a lot of linear media work that goes into being a game composer. You know, cutscenes and trailers and what have you. So certainly I had had, you know, practice, and I'd also done some short films and things like that. I would say that it's different. The structure of it is different. In some ways it's easier because you come into it, you pretty much know what the structure is. And so with a game, sometimes you can get mired down in these very philosophical and challenging, like intellectual pursuits, like technology and, you know, trying to do something novel with the actual deployment of the music. Where I think in a movie, it's at times can feel a little bit more like paint by numbers once you figure out some essential ideas about the score, and so in that way they can be good counterparts because they stroke different parts of the brain for me.
The film, and my co-host on the podcast, Dallas, this was his favorite film of the past decade. What was it like when the small film, like It Follows, came out of nowhere and it really blew people away. People loved the film, the score, the concept. What was it like for you to have that film explode into the world like that?
It was really cool and exciting. It was a surprise. I mean, none of us expected that. But we also, you know, we were proud of the movie, so I guess it wasn't. I mean, it was a surprise, but at the same time, we knew that we had something good, I would say.
The score as well, obviously, got a great reception, and it seems that it's inspired a lot of kind of people since that. I just sort of read today as well that sort of it's Stranger Things. It's a show I haven't actually seen myself, but I'm familiar with some of the music. They look to try and get you on board, and a lot of people have sort of looked at your score at It Follows and tried to sort of adapt it themselves. How does that kind of feel for you to know that you've inspired people in a positive or maybe in different ways?
Yeah, it's fascinating for sure. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's sort of, I guess there are positives and negatives to it. At least personally, I mean, it's flattering to have been a part of something that felt like it was on some sort of wave of like just bringing that sort of style back into back into pop culture to a certain degree, but at the same time it can be challenging for sure. Just the comparisons and I guess hearing lots of things that sound very similar to something that you had done before and sort of the ramifications of that.
Under the Silver Lake came along next for you, and it's one of my and my co-host's favorite films of the year. And I actually listened to a podcast sort of when I was coming along, getting ready to interview you today, and Quentin Tarantino himself said that it was favorite film of the year. When did David first approach you for this film, and when did you sort of first hear about this whole story?
Well, I didn't know that it was Tarantino's favorite film. That's cool.
Yeah, it's on the podcast. It's like an MTV one, the happy, sad, confused one. Like the host asked him, like, which directors do you kind of see today that you would love to like kind of get on with and talk and share work? And he went, David Robert Mitchell was one of those guys. And he was like, Under the Silver Lake is my favorite film of the year so far.
It's funny, actually, because that script, David wrote that before he wrote It Follows. But, you know, given the nature of it, it's very ambitious. It took longer, I think, to just get the wheels in motion to make that movie. As soon as I read the script, I thought it was crazy in a good way, and really wanted to work on it. And so much so that I would say that it was one of the main reasons that I moved to Los Angeles to really kind of be involved in the filmmaking process, to get involved in during pre-production and really kind of learn more about what it's like to make a movie. And it's sort of all of the elements that go into the music side of things. And so, I was on that project for over a year. I did a lot of pre-production on the project because there was a lot of music, you know, that happens on screen. Including, you know, some pretty challenging scenes, like the songwriter sequence, which is like a 10-minute, you know, piano medley during a dialogue sequence, which was very, very hard. It was David put a lot of faith in me, asking me to do a fully orchestral score, which is something I'd never done before, really. That was really cool. It was very, very challenging. And I had a ton of help to make it happen. It definitely was not always fun. It was pretty difficult at times. By the end of it, I was pretty beat, I would say, pretty burnt out by the whole thing. But we're really proud of the work that we did for that movie.
Were you sort of aware yourself of the noir genre and the type of scores that have been kind of historically associated with it?
Not really. I didn't really have any familiarity with noir before that. I mean, certainly I knew about the genre and sort of had, I would say I had some sort of light touchstones, kind of similar to what my relationship to horror was when I started It Follows. That being said, I think this style of music was a lot more challenging for me to step into. And so the approach that I took with It Follows, the intentional ignorance kind of approach, I couldn't do in quite the same way with this movie. I felt like I needed a little bit more help. So I watched a handful of noir films. I watched Vertigo and Taxi Driver and Blue Velvet and Citizen Kane, just to kind of get a better understanding of the language. And it also was really my first introduction to the work of Bernard Herrmann, which I really fell in love with. I mean, that all said, I tried to follow a similar approach in that, I would listen to the temp, you know, a couple times, try to distill it down. Actually, on Silver Lake, I developed a slightly different technique for scoring with off temp, which was to kind of like create like a roadmap for myself, where I would kind of like lay down markers for different beats in a scene, and sort of equate different phrases or adjectives to those beats. Just to kind of give me some structure to help me move through the process a little more quickly, because the whole process just took a lot longer than anything I'd been used to before, just having to, you know, do a lot of the orchestral arrangement and stuff like that. So I definitely needed some extra tools and tricks and things like that to make it happen.
Do you sort of score to film or create different themes for David to play with and use in the edit? What's sort of that relationship like for you two?
So for Silver Lake, we actually had an intention to write music ahead of time to have Julio, the editor, and David cut the movie to, but it ended up not being very practical. It requires a lot of writing that you wouldn't normally have to do. And a lot of that writing can go to waste because you're doing it in a preliminary fashion and there's no guarantee that it's less likely to hit the nail. It's less likely to hit the target because it's not, you're sort of like, it's more like instead of reacting to the film being shaped, you're sort of like trying to help dictate it. So it ended up not really making sense for us. And so we kind of ended up going back to what we knew. Also, part of that too is that I had taken a couple of cracks at sort of a direction for music before we ended up doing an orchestral score. Something that was a little bit more of a blend of orchestra and guitars and synthesizers and stuff like that. And it just wasn't really what David was hoping for. I think he wanted to incorporate more of a referential feeling to the score, that like the picture itself is very much, you know, nodding towards other noir films. So we ended up going in a more traditional direction as far as like what we had done before our approach.
When you've brought so many sort of unique touches and ideas to this score, and I got the impression listening to it that it was a lot of fun to sort of design and be creative on, how did you sort of convey all the different signs and the ideas of patterns into the score so well?
It was pretty hard. I tried to keep track of all the threads, all the narrative threads, and you know, I also tried to be suggestive when I could of other potential threats that I personally saw. It sort of was just like collecting sort of a box of ideas over time. Things like the hobo codes, and the homeless king. That whole arc of the story sort of has like a suite of motifs that are sort of centered around this whistling melody that I came up with in a bathroom. I just recorded it on my phone in a bathroom, and then that recording is what you hear in the film. But then there are also passages where they're talking about things related to the Hobo King, where, for instance, the score might be it might be accompanying the whistle melody, but the whistle's been omitted, or there are situations where the whistle is played backwards and used as sort of like a frightening effect. And then when we meet the Hobo King, that whistle sort of like, in a way, it's meant to sort of morph into a more tangible motif with a clarinet, a solo clarinet, but it has the same sort of style to it. And that's like just one of the many, many different threads that the score tries to like take advantage of. It's in a way it was great because it gave me a lot of inspiration and fodder to work with. But certainly it was challenging to figure out how to create the correct sort of narrative arcs for all the different themes that are in the score.
Was it a challenge to score the film? You obviously don't want to play your hand too early and get ahead of Sam's journey, but then again, you really are really great in this score of doing the foreshadowing.
Yeah, that's definitely something that we talked about. I mean, there's a balance there as far as like what you want to foreshadow and what you just want to support or stagger like behind the story. So I think the squirrel ended up being kind of the perfect opportunity to do a little bit of foreshadowing. I mean, there's no context for that. So, you know, it's attaching a thematic element to that doesn't really give anything away. And it's such a bizarre sequence that clearly, and the way that it's shot, it's meant to suggest that there's something wrong. It's not one of these circumstances where the film isn't really getting at anything or it's not trying to be suggestive, but perhaps the music is. And, you know, in those circumstances, sometimes you may not want to be doing that because that may be running against sort of the grain of what the intention is with the movie. But certainly the intention of the squirrel scene was to kind of set you up for a weird journey. And so it was a great place to start to get, you know, start to suggest sort of the nature of the world that the movie takes place in.
Did you get much say over the music used in the film, like the R.E.M. track? Also, any sort of involvement in the character of the songwriter? What was sort of your involvement in the other kind of music used in the film, and sort of maybe even developing the songwriter character and maybe contributing ideas that he could have invented, for example?
Yeah, the songwriter was a fairly fully fledged idea in the script, but we had meetings about the songs that we would use, and you know there were a lot of logistical considerations for that, mostly that had to do with licensing and money, and so you know part of those conversations was bringing alternative song ideas to the table, and so there were probably like five or six of us at those meetings who were all bringing our own ideas to the table as far as what kind of songs we could include. And for instance, like Gymnopédie, the Eric Satie piece was something that I had suggested as sort of an entry point to the sequence, something that wouldn't alarm you as an audience member. It would kind of, you know, it would sort of nurse you into the sequence. And then one idea that I sort of snuck in there was to have the songwriter playing the initial cue with one hand. And so that arrangement of Gymnopédie that he plays is totally, you can totally play it with a single hand. That was a little idea that I threw in there. And then there are other things that we did. And that's one of the great things about working with David is he's very open to, you know, other people's ideas. So there are some Easter eggs in the film that, musical Easter eggs, I'd be hesitant to just outright give away, but you know, sometimes some things got added pretty late, you know, would be, you know, on the mix stage, and, you know, there'd be a sequence, and, you know, we just have an idea, like, wouldn't it be great if, you know, X, and then we would throw that in the movie. So in that way it was pretty cool.
When the film ended, premiered at Cannes, it ended up being sort of recut afterwards. Did you have to get involved again and score into a different cut, or was your work sort of done and dusted by that stage?
I don't really know. I'm not really sure about the recut. I've heard that there wasn't a recut, but I've also heard that there was a recut. I mean, I didn't notice. When I saw the film at AFI, I didn't notice any differences between the Cannes version and the AFI version. So if there are cuts, they are they're news to me.
We've sort of discussed on the show that the Under the Silver Lake we felt was really badly handled by A24. At one point it would vanish from the website, it got a really sort of weird rollout, and I think we'll see it at the end of the year on a lot of best of the year film lists from critics and fans. As someone that was so closely involved in this film, what was your reaction to the rollout, and what could have maybe been done differently? Because it feels like people are managing to find the film now. It's always kind of top tier in sort of the iTunes charts, you know, as we mentioned, someone like Tarantino is going on and saying, hey, this is my favorite film of the year, and that'll probably bring in a lot of a crowd too. What could have been done differently to the rollout, and what was your reaction to it as someone that was kind of closely involved?
It was definitely frustrating. I think I guess I would have liked to see a more like firm commitment to the film. I think that the release was a little bizarre, and I don't really understand the details of that, but my best guess would be that there was some hesitation maybe to get fully behind the film because of the reception to it being so mixed. You know, it's definitely not for everybody, so that's my best guess, but I'm not really privy to the details of that.
Which makes it all the more kind of odd when you think of something like Under the Silver Lake. It seems to fit in with that filmography that some of their films can be divisive, you know, they're not all perhaps universal. Like someone will, you know, a lot of people like Under the Silver Lake, some people might be baffled by it. It just seems odd that a film that seems such a perfect fit for them just didn't seem to get the rollout that a lot of other films have got in the past. It really was quite odd from us on the outside kind of looking in on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I got the sense that there might be political motivations for it, but I mean, it's a lot of it is just hunches. It's not really, I don't really know what the actual reasons are, but certainly, you know, the reception was very mixed, so I could imagine that being a part of it.
What's it like when you see that there seems to be that shift that at Cannes it had this mixed reception, but then it seems to be sort of in the space of a year of Cannes, it's had this sort of smaller release, but people are finding it, people are talking about it. What's it like for you when you see that sort of shift from a year ago to now, and I'm wondering where it might even be in sort of another year's time? Do you think Under the Silver Lake is going to be one of those films that, how did we miss this one? How did we not get the chance to see this one at the cinema?
I think it's definitely reassuring, like, seeing the shift as the movie has gotten out to a broader audience, you know, beyond, like, sort of the critics and, you know, gatekeepers and stuff like that. I mean, certainly there is an audience for a film like this, and I think it has sort of a cult appeal to it. You know, it's a very bizarre, quirky, fun movie. I think with time it's shown to be, I think that the longer it goes on, the more, I guess we feel good about it and feel vindicated that we, you know, we made something that, you know, to be proud of, that we are fully behind. Yeah, I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about publishers, to be honest.
Then sort of Triple Frontier was your next feature, and that was by sort of J.C. Chandler. What was he sort of looking for from you as a composer?
So Triple Frontier, they were looking for... It was kind of an interesting project because you had a director who had never done an action movie before and had never done a big budget movie before. And so, in a way, it felt like a good fit in that regard because we were all kind of stepping into something new together, and we had the experience that you need to do that, but also the lack of familiarity to bring something new to it. And I think it was a little more vague, perhaps, going into that as far as like what the sound needed to be. And so part of that process was figuring that out. Certainly, some of that was figured out with temp material, but some of it was just initial sort of concepting. And so, you know, pretty early on, I had like made some sketch material, and they really liked it. We had talked about like guitars and treating guitars like orchestra, syncopated sort of like percussion. And that's kind of the way the score went, you know, lots of snare drums and toms, syncopated drums, lots of string textures, not just like orchestra, but also like bowed acoustic guitars and, electric guitars and just all kinds of string like sounds. So yeah, I mean, it had a very different trajectory than any other project I've worked on, and I ended up writing quite a lot of music for the film because of their process, how they cut the film, how they incorporated music into their work. They relied a lot heavier on the composer to help them sort of figure out sequences, and less so on the temp score. So it required more writing, I would say.
Triple Frontier was obviously a Netflix release. Does that involve a different mindset to movies like It Follows and Under the Silver Lake, knowing that apart from maybe the odd person, like the entire audience will largely be hearing your score through TVs, laptops, mobile devices? How do you sort of compose for a film like that, knowing that people might not be watching it with the best sound systems in the world? Do you think about that, or do you think of it like I'm going to shoot for it as if it's going to be on the big screen?
It certainly comes to mind. I mean, I don't know if it changes my approach too much. I mean, I want the music to cut through. And I would say that the elements in the film tend to dictate that more than the form factor. You know, the fact that the movie has a ton of sound effects and dialogue, you know, that definitely informs sort of the style of the music and sort of the frequency content of the music. You know, there were certain things stylistically that worked well stylistically for the film, but didn't always work well logistically. You know, like having lots of like odd rhythms and syncopation didn't always work out, because when the audience is trying to track, you know, sound effects and dialogue and all these different things, it can just get lost in that sort of soup of sound. So it was definitely a challenge to I found that I had to keep distilling my music down to simpler forms to make the music work better for certain sequences.
And kind of finally, what are you working on at the moment that people can maybe look forward to hearing it when they're watching some films soon?
Film-wise, the next film I'm working on is called The Hole in the Fence by a Mexican director named Joaquin Del Paso, and that's shooting right now. The rest of my projects currently are in other mediums, so I'm working on two games, and I'm working on a TV show. And I have a theater project that I'm also working on, so trying to, shift back and forth a little bit. It keeps me sane to have different things to work on.
You're certainly a man for all mediums, and thank you so much for coming on today to talk about your work and the stuff that you've done. It's been a real pleasure to hear the man behind such great scores.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.